West Side. To live and die in LA, where everybody try to fatten their pocket. So many hustle for the cash, so it's hard to knock it. Everybody got their own thing, currency chasing worldwide.
Well, hello, hello, hello. God bless you, community family, and welcome to Gang Talk. We were just listening to Tupac. Tupac has been our introduction music for the year and a half. We've been blessed to be online now and extend the work that started in radio in 2009. So it's a blessing to be here to share this hour with our community family, as we are blessed by the guests that join us every week and blessed to have Skip Townsend as our co-host.
Well, thank you, sister. I give all honor and praise to God. I'm just truly grateful to be alive and to be here and to share in this this weekly, I want to say blessing, because it truly is a blessing with the guests that we have come on, especially tonight. I'm overexcited tonight, you know, with the guests we have. So I'm just truly grateful. I give all honor and praise to God. I'm grateful to be here.
Yes, me too. And the biggest gratitude is having God restore you to us.
Yes.
That's the biggest success story in this room, and we have a few folks that can share that with us. By example, last week.
Oh, yes, indeed. So I definitely want to thank our guests from last week, and I was sitting here counting on my fingers, and between three individuals, not counting Kathy Wooten,
right.
But you know, Kathy too has spent about 4 or 5 years in prison,
yes.
But just with the three men that she brought, it represented 84 years lost in state prison.
Yeah.
Dennis and Prentice,
mm-hmm.
And I forgot the young man, Carl
right. McKinney. Mm-hmm.
So I'm truly grateful for Kathy Wooten, whose two children were murdered 45
yes.
days apart. And she's out here working in the community to bring resolve and peace to the community conflict. So
yeah.
My hat always goes off to Kathy, because she's truly a community leader, and for organizing and bringing those young men together.
Yes.
You know, and they could be anywhere. They were saying, oh, I got out in December, or I got out in March. So, you know, they could be anywhere behind a safety of a house somewhere with a little poodle and a wife, like, I'm not coming back outside. But they gave it their time, you know, to actually come and engage so that young people won't follow in those footsteps. So
right.
I'm truly grateful for people who do that.
Me
it's
too.
Easy to just go home and say, okay, I made it.
Yeah.
But they're actually in the community spreading the word, making mm-hmm. sure that people understand that's not the path.
And the beauty, too, about their story. Uh-oh.
Right, it's all right.
There's recovery.
Yes,
you know, in that, which one? Prentice is working in the railroad yard.
Yes.
And Dennis has soldering.
Welding. He has
welding. Yeah, not soldering. We
yes,
don't want
indeed.
To get those confused.
So
but
he actually learned a trade.
Yes, he's
yes.
learned a trade, and we're very happy about that, because that's what our men have to come back to. They have
right.
to have a way to maintain their survival.
Right.
Yeah. So we are grateful for them and the mm-hmm. courage it took for them to come and tell us their
yes,
story.
Indeed.
And we're always grateful to Kathy and the trauma that she's suffered in her life with her children, as with Barbara.
Right.
They came together, and both ladies have had two of their sons murdered in this
right.
violence. So for them to have the courage to come and talk about that is to be applauded, and the examples to show us that what we talk about is not a joke. There's nothing funny in these scenarios, but we are going to recover from this.
Right.
That's the best news in this hour. So God bless you, community family. Bless you, Skip, for joining us. And let's start with our introductions.
Yes, indeed. So just simply say your name. We're going to go around with the young fellow with the ceasefire hat on, and we're going to come this way. Just simply say your name, and, you know.
My name is Jaime Gregory, also known as Rare Breed.
All right. Appreciate you.
I'm Jim Lawson, better known perhaps as the Reverend Jim Lawson, Reverend James M. Lawson, Jr.
My name's Nick Gilley.
Right, okay. Well, that was quick introduction.
Yeah, because you didn't give him a chance to give us a little background that they
right.
may want to
so,
share with our listeners.
So let's go back this way, starting
okay.
with Nick.
Nick.
Just a little background, and we'll go back
yeah.
around
okay.
that way.
Anything you want to share with us? Mm-hmm.
It's great to be here. My name is Nick. Like I said, I've been friends with Skip and Sister Heron for a while. I'm grateful to know you. Very happy to have a giant and a hero here, Reverend Lawson, and I'm looking forward to, as always, hearing what he has to say.
Yes, indeed.
Well, one way for me to begin is to say that this 2017 is the 50th year for me to have had a face-to-face encounter with Martin Luther King Jr., February the 6th, 1957. I had just returned from India, where I was a coach and phys ed teacher and campus minister. And he spoke up in Oberlin, Ohio, at Oberlin College. And this is a fantastic story because when black folk in that northeastern part of Ohio heard that Martin Luther King Jr. was going to speak at Oberlin College in the Finney Chapel, they came in yellow school buses from all around the region. So that before 11 o'clock came, which was the time of the chapel, the place was almost all full of black people. There's little room for students on the campus. It came from Elyria and Springfield and Youngstown and Worcester and Massillon and Toni Morrison's town. Mm. They came from all over that area and jam-packed that small college town and that chapel. So it was, for me, important because while I had met Martin Luther King Jr. on the front pages of the Nagpur Times in Nagpur, India, where I was living, December 1st, 1955, and had been expecting such a campaign to happen from my college days in 1950-51, this was the first time we shook hands and talked together. And so a part of my own life, therefore, has been continuing the activism against racism and against violence and against misinterpretations of the Christian gospel and the Bible and all, and an effort to bend my life in that direction. So Martin King was a voice of God for me, and as we talked and visited, we had a lot in common. And when I said I was going to get a degree, or one or two degrees in theology, Bible and theology, then perhaps move south, Martin King said, come now, don't wait, we need you now. So I dropped out of graduate school at Oberlin and was able to move by January after another semester. So by January 1958, had settled into an apartment in Nashville, Tennessee, and began work around the southeastern part of the country. I knew and met and knew all the Little Rock Nine, Daisy Bates in Little Rock. I met the Clinton 12, who had their school bombed in Clinton, East Tennessee. I met many of the people of Montgomery bus boycott, Rosa Parks, Mary Jo Robinson, and a host of others. I met people from Louisiana, Texas, in many of the meetings that were going on, many of the bombings that went on. So that was a part of my life as both as a rover and then in many activities, and then decided with friends in Nashville to organize the sit-in campaign in Nashville, the Nashville campaign, to show that the Montgomery bus boycott was not an accident, but nonviolent direct action. The politics of nonviolent action, the politics of action, was a form of action that we in the black community needed to take up and use to begin our resistance to racism in every form, Jim Crow law in practice. So looking back on it now, I can say that we, King and the Montgomery Bus Boycott and SCLC and later SNCC, which I helped to organize, became the first major black resistance movement to 20th century Jim Crow law, dark codes, a codified racism that was very, very, very apparent in the southeastern part of the country and some of the parts of Southwest, South Central, but was epidemic all across the country.
Right. Hold on 1 second, Dr. Lawson, because I want the young man to introduce himself. I got 100 questions for you, so
yes,
I want you
do.
To hold on because I because there's so much, and you just brought up SNCC too, and I'm sitting here next to Nick, so I want to bring up some questions about that. But real quick,
I'm overwhelmed right now.
Yes, indeed, it is.
Sitting next to some history, and I'm honored to be here because you know, I'm carrying on a legacy of a movement, you know, that started years with brothers like him. So, you know, I'm overwhelmed. Right. But I'm Jaime Rare Breed Gregory. I do gospel rap. I'm executive board member of Southern California Ceasefire. I also work with the Gang Reduction Youth Development with Mayor Garcetti. I work with the Hip Hop Church LA organization as outreach coordinator. And I just push music for the movement, and I just do my part in this intervention world. And I consider myself an activist out here pushing this line of peace.
Yes. Right. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of what we wanted to hear, the history from Dr. Lawson, but also bring it up to 2017 and see how we can apply it with this generation. Because unfortunately, not enough of our young men know the history and the struggle. They don't recognize that we have crossed these bridges before. And we ask you to join us tonight to talk to them in a spiritual way. You know, we have a lot of our young men that have lost their faith. They don't have any faith.
Right.
They don't believe there's a place for them in this country and in this world. And you represent the generation that fought for our place.
Right. Right. So for me, I'm thinking there weren't as many distractions back then.
Right.
You know, it seems like your generation, you guys were focused, mm-hmm. that this is our job, this is our obligation, yeah. this is our duty. You talked about SNCC, and I had the opportunity to be at the 50th reunion in, I think it was South Carolina, one of those Carolinas, and I saw the men were with their families. And it just, it blew, I felt overwhelmed just so much. So can you maybe talk something about that? Did you guys have the distractions? Because now we got rap music, we got Crips and Bloods, and we're fighting each other. And I met a man who said he was shot by Caucasian people stopping him from being one of the freedom riders and the freedom singers. So did you guys have the distractions and maybe work through them better or what?
Well, I want to say, first of all, that that in my judgment, our young people and the young people who move into gangs and whatnot have been molded by a USA culture of violence and nothingness, which has multiplied its nothingness since the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. So this kind of society, the technology of the society, the iPhones, the podcast,
the internet, all
the
of it.
Internet, all of this, is it, we did not have that, so that's true. So the society today has multiplied the ways in which it wants the USA people to think of themselves as individual billiard balls on a billiards table and a pool table, and not to know their rootage in the human past or in then the immediate past of USA history and also the past of black folk in this country. So I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, but I'm saying that USA culture has become more violent than ever before, with huge technologies of violence, with huge public funds being used Act for Organized Violence, yeah. Military.
Yeah.
And if you look at Central Asia, Middle East, or eastern part of Congo, you'll see what that organized violence has done and is doing. But I'm saying that the impact of our society has tripled, or if not 100%, then tripled or more, doubled its effort to keep USA people safely embedded in this culture and not embedded in their own power, individuality, in their own souls.
Okay. So my next question, I'm going to get off the mic real quick. My next question goes exactly what you're saying. So then, therefore, do you think that it was a mistake to want to emulate this society for integration, or should we have stayed separated and allow Jim Crow to work because of individuals like yourself, individuals like Marion Barry, Danny Glover, all the different people who are working with SNCC and other organizations? We could have been a powerful entity as black people without help. Do you think about that?
Well, of course, that is a profound issue that various people and scholars are still battling. But I maintain that God's purpose for the human race has never been developing of tyranny, oppression, racism, sexism, violence, plantation capitalism. That's my contention. That God's destiny and purpose for human beings is that we, on the one side, should discover what Gandhi of India called the raw power of the universe, the power of life, the power of love, the power of truth, the invisible power from which we have come. That human beings are to discover that power that's in each one of us, and then at the same time in discovering it, know that it's rooted in the long journey of the human family towards the purpose of allowing the human race to develop this planet Earth in a fashion that will reflect truth and justice.
As a black woman in this world, in this country, I am just fixated on our needs. I'd like to be generous and inclusive, but as I see our struggle continue, and from your days to his days to the days of my children get worse, I'm fixated on the black agenda and what we need to do as a people. And Skip asked the question a different way I would have asked.
Okay, good.
Has assimilation worked for us or worked against us?
All right. Now remember that while certain black folk called for integration, Martin King used the term, but Martin King's primary emphasis, and my own, was desegregation. Demolishing Jim Crow law and practice, which helped from 1866 maybe. For an example, the ex-slave was probably the most skilled workforce in the country. Mm-hmm. Welding, electricity, carpentry, concrete work, steel work, road building, house building, farm building, baking,
all of that.
Okay, one of the realities of Jim Crow law and practice that organized with the KKK and the plantation owners and business was the determination that those black folk who came off the plantation would not be allowed to work in their fields, mm-hmm. in their skills. Yeah. So the one of the things that the KK did was to have covenants in Pulaski, Tennessee, where this began, with the city, with the county, with various business people, that the ex-slave, no matter how skilled a welder, could not be a welder in Pulaski, Tennessee, or South Bend, Indiana, or in Cincinnati, Ohio. So one of the issues that we have to face is the prohibition of Jim Crow law was a prohibition that said you have to stay poor. Mm-hmm. You may not work. This is a terrible story.
Yes, it is.
Baseball, beginning in the 19th century, had black players in it. Jim Crow law, in practice, kicked those ball players out of that professional baseball league, and so it could not, it did not again hire baseball players until 1947 with Jackie Robinson.
Right.
Well, now, right. What's going on in the world where skilled human beings, qualified human beings in all sorts of fields, cannot work in their fields. Mm-hmm. I mean, in their discipline, mm-hmm. in that for which they've been qualified. Mm-hmm. The only people who could teach were people who could teach in black schools.
Right.
So the only educators who could be educators, and they did an enormous piece of work in the 20th century, in my judgment. And we should not fault them by dismissing them or calling them Uncle Toms. They're out of the hoop. They did enormous work for us. But the desegregation movement was essential for our history. And if there's weakness in the black community today, I would say, in terms of movement and struggle together, it's the weakness of the fact that many black folk were highly qualified in 1960 and 1970 to rise in scientific research and teach at the university level, become university presidents, and serve in this field and that field and everywhere across the country. And they were waiting for the opportunity to get in there, and they've taken advantage of it. The downside of that is that that's taken off of the leadership in the black community, black churches, black institutions, then a layer of committed working people. And so we don't have that leadership. They have to find a way now to provide leadership to change the USA agenda so that the black agenda, the agenda of the slave and the ex-slave, becomes the agenda of the country.
I say we have to have our own.
Yeah.
I would think that, so for me, you know, and no disrespect, I truly appreciate your life and everybody else's, but for me, I believe that there are too many valuable people as yourself, Harry Belafonte, and those that I've named, who could have helped us through this transition so that if we had landowners back then. I know people who've owned land, so we could have had black people work for black people. You hire black. We create communities. There's so many lands that were sold that were black farmers.
And stolen. Lands that were stolen.
Right, in Florida, too. Remember that?
Lands that were stolen.
Rosedale,
well, I'm not opposing that. I'm saying, for example, I mean, I was a pastor of black congregations. I did not try to desegregate those congregations into some kind of mixture.
No, so our churches really were our political hub.
So I'm saying that I'm not saying desegregation and all of that to the discrediting of the black experience, unity and development and community and institutions. That must become an essential way in which we work. And hence my own work in the black church, always. So I'm not disavowing that. And so I think that work has to go on. But you're not going to stop. You're not going to stop the Harry Belafontes or the John Lewis's,
right,
who moved to access the opportunities that we have broken open or are breaking open, and then to provide regional and national leadership that has to be molded.
So I've got a question.
So I'm not saying either or,
right,
or I'm not for either or. I'm saying both and okay, all.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
In terms of what you're saying, Skip, and what Sister's saying, and I don't want to monopolize too much of the time because I want to hear what Reverend Lawson is saying. I think it's more important. But it's I have so many issues with the emotional ease of your argument. So who is we? In your sentence, you said
anytime we. I say we, I'm speaking for black people.
But no, Skip, there is no black people.
We're not black.
Yeah, we are. But Skip, there are different. I mean, you know, you're talking about 25 million people, and you're talking. For instance, I'm from Chicago. Harold Washington was a great mayor in Chicago,
right,
and when he died in his desk, the black aldermen and the white aldermen were barricaded in City Hall, and in the basement of City Hall, and Jesse Jackson was there, they decided who the next black mayor would be. And that person was pro-business, and that person was pro-exclusivity. That person had an agenda, and that person was black. So when you say we, there is no monolithic black people that can go marching towards landowning in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. It's a complex system. Yeah. And what I heard Reverend Lawson mm-hmm. say is that system has been affected by the capitalism and yes. the military capitalism of the history of the United States. We can't disassociate ourselves from the water that we've been swimming in for 200 years. So, you know, it's emotionally satisfying to say we should do this. But who the hell is we?
Is we?
Yeah. Because the we in the south side of Chicago has abandoned my city, including my generation.
Right.
It was very different in the south side when I was young there. It's not the same, largely because some we's moved away and left the other we's there. And then some we's were black and participated in the sale of Cabrini Green, which then scattered other we's across the south side of Chicago. And so then groups of communities of young we's, do you see what I'm saying?
Okay, so
it's
very complex.
And
I think
we
that
can't
that
just
is,
be.
But I think that is as a political design, as you said, whether they were barricading the office. But
I didn't say political. I'm saying it's a spiritual design. I'm saying that there is an energy in the United States of America that acts like a spiritual force, that people operate under its behest and aren't even aware they're doing so. I absolutely do not think that there is any one or two or group of evil white men or black men who are near smart enough to organize that and to puppet us all marching along.
Hey, you're deep tonight.
I've been having this argument before. Like, it's far worse and far more complex.
Absolutely.
And it's very fun to say that we should just do this thing, but I think it's way worse than that, and we have to be logical.
Can I add something in here, see, because for clarification purposes, the leadership of the Black Panther Party were educated
right.
men. They were educated men, and they used the Constitution to bear arms, okay? They were eliminated because of that agenda. All of them eliminated because of that agenda. And shortly after the Panthers were eliminated, that crack virus showed up. Okay? And it took his generation. So when Skip
my
says we
also.
Okay.
My
our,
whole
and
generation
it, it started in mine. Okay? And I have to admit that. And it was just a snake that we allowed in, not knowing it was a snake. Because if we'd have known it was a snake, you know, you don't let the snake in, you know it. But what I'm trying to say is that I get this sense that assimilation pit us against each other economically and success-oriented,
right.
Competitive agendas hit our community that destroyed the unity that raised Dr. Lawson, that raised me. You see, so the assimilation, as Skip and some of the young people have said, Dr. King said that his greatest fear was that he may have led us, his people, into a burning house. You see that he had some regrets of the movement,
yeah,
that didn't come through the way he had anticipated our people would receive the freedom from the Jim Crow. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Lawson, about the concept of separate but equal.
Well,
I put a lot in there, but
yeah, no,
you know, it's all about the assimilation and how has that helped us or hurt us, really?
Well, I don't use the term assimilation because,
okay,
I don't think there may be some of that, but that isn't the issue that most black folk are facing. Most black folk are facing a daily hostility,
yes,
a system whereby they cannot get the work they need and,
yes,
want for,
yes,
their families and themselves. So I don't use the word assimilation,
okay,
and I don't use the word, I tend not to use the word integration, because I think that the struggle of black people must of necessity primarily be a struggle to dismantle the massacring of our people,
mm-hmm,
which is what I saw myself increasingly doing in my 17 years in the South, desegregating the society. Now, that came out of deep roots in black people. In the Montgomery bus boycott, December 1 to January 17th, I think it was, 1958, 381 days, where some 50,000 people stayed off the buses, and many of them walked, and they organized their own transportation system with cars.
Yeah.
Now, that came from black women,
right,
who had experienced more than any other group in the Montgomery the hostility, mm, and the hurt and brokenness of the white bus drivers, mm, who drove those buses. And a black person could not be a mechanic. A black person could not be a driver. A black person could not be a secretary. A black person could not work in the office. Only maids. So it's black women who then said in Montgomery and then later in Nashville that the system of hostility that is segregation has to be dismantled. So they led me, in fact, to recognize that the desegregation issue of the Constitution and the desegregation of schools that began in the 30s, legal, were important strategies that came out of primarily black parents and the NAACP, local chapters and whatnot. But that agenda was a limited agenda. And Rosa Parks and Louise West and Vera Carr and Mary Jo Robinson were some of the voices in Montgomery that said there's another agenda. We catch hell from the segregated system.
Yes.
Doesn't matter what we're doing.
No, it
we
doesn't.
Live on. So we're catching hell, and so we need to stop it there. And then as I organized in Nashville for the next major campaign of direct action, it was black women who set our agenda. Mm-hmm. They said we must desegregate downtown Nashville. It was a scene where women taking their children to buy a pair of shoes could not try a pair of shoes on for the 9-year-old boy.
Yes, but Dr. Lawson, okay, we need to bring this up to 2017 and talk about the things that we are still going through after all the years of struggle and the work that you invested to make change for us. Has it been realized?
All right. The point I would make is that the job, the work of dismantling the old injustices that still hurt our people must become the major agenda. Not a simulation, not this, not that, but continue the work of desegregating this society, whether it's in housing,
schools,
or whatever, whether it's the whole issue of the structured poverty of plantation capitalism in the United States, which is the major, a major injustice in the United States. So local communities need to organize themselves. I think we have to do the work of helping our young people move out of gangs, but that is healing work and repairing work. That's restoration work. They have become, without making conscious decisions, they have become victims of our USA culture
Of
violence.
And that's
and so, to work.
I want you to talk to him because this man is a spiritual warrior. He's a rapper for God, and he's turned his life around from just what you were talking about. But he's now trying to guide the next generation, and we need to build these bridges between you and him so he can build the bridges between him and them. You see, we've got to connect this.
I'm sitting here listening, and I'm looking for answers. I came initially to be on the show not really knowing the aspect of what we were talking about, and now, you know, I sit in silence because I'm looking for that answer, because you pass the torch to people like myself, and now we kind of get puzzled on what direction to go with this torch and what should we do, because we become we begin to spin our wheels when people get complacent when they reach a peak of their purpose and not elevating past that peak of the purpose. And now, like for myself, I'm looking for these answers, and for me to be here is a blessing, because I promise, like last week, I was in that mindset of like, what's my next level to this movement? Like, and because I do music for the movement, and I'm pushing a song at this present time to speak life into the community and bring a call to action for unity and better structure, and to really stand as one and stop segregating ourselves with the beef and conflict amongst peacemakers. There's a lot of conflict amongst peacemakers right now, and we don't know. We're not at a time. I don't believe we're at a time where we're waiting on the next Malcolm or Martin to lead the masses. We're waiting. It's time for leaders to learn how to follow other leaders, support other leaders, step up when it's time for you to lead, and then they support you as well.
Okay, but I think I would like to say that I'm not sure there is such a thing as my generation. I'm going to be 90 in 14 months, 15
That's
months.
Your heart.
And I'm hitting 89 in September.
Wow.
So I don't know whether there can be such a thing as my generation, which is Martin King's generation, because he and I were the same age. Yeah. So I don't know. If the issue is how we pass on to you anything. I think that I know that I could, that my task may be really more to sit with you in common conversation and struggle to see where we are, and then to see how we continue to move forward.
Exactly.
But that's only one issue. Because how do we get the black preachers to get off this kick of prosperity Christianity? Prosperity Bible.
Another we.
and to get get into the business of doing justice one by one in their own congregation. I never hear, I rarely hear a sermon that emphasizes the fact of Jesus' teaching. Jesus said to a large multitude of people, according to the book of Matthew, they were a multitude of people, and various crowds followed him. Apparently, in the four books we have about this first century man, various kinds of crowds followed him wherever he went. To that multitude of people, he said, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." I don't hear churches preaching that.
Right.
I mean, the doctrine and dogma of sin has become an abject dogma that's almost a dogma of control and domination, rather than a spirituality of power.
Can I use the word assimilate? Because that's what they've done. Yeah. They've been victimized for so long that they've used the same tools that were used to victimize them that they now victimize the congregation, the members of their church. I won't use the word assimilation.
Let me just tell you, Dr. Murray, Cecil Murray was here, and on at least two occasions, maybe three, he said the two things that have consumed the black churches are ego and greed. Ego and greed.
Yeah.
And this is why they're not serving the community historically like they used to when the movement was at its greatest. When our movement was at its greatest, our churches were solid.
And any number of pastors and any number of communities, we don't even know the stories.
We don't.
Of our own people.
And this is why I was trying to bring your history into his arena so that they can have guidance and know that, you know, the struggle was real and real men were in it. And he's in a different kind of struggle that needs to kind of build on your shoulders to help them build on his. You see what I'm saying? We're trying to make this the generational connection that we've always been as a people.
But
this is what we've lost.
It would be, however, my own contention that that movements that are going to be effective for social change have to be intergenerational movements.
Right.
And there's a romanticism in our society that's cultivated by the media and the academy. For example, the National Sit-In Movement, again and again, is called a student movement. Well, it's true that King had just gotten out from finishing his PhD dissertation, so he was still a student. And it's true that I was also engaged in theological studies at the graduate level, so I was still a student. But at the time of the sit-in campaign, which I helped basically do the organizing of, I was, I think, 31. And from a sociological point of view, which was my college major, I recognized that students on the one side had an energetic freedom that their mothers and fathers did not have, and that therefore to weld the student energy and idealism with people like C.T. Vivian, who was actually in the Nashville campaign, and Helen Roberts and Dolores Wilkerson and Kelly Miller Smith, who was a pastor, that to bring all of that together and to work together oftentimes on a first-name basis and see ourselves as the community for social justice, the community for change, and see all of us ourselves as people of equality, not as hierarchical, was the most important kind of organizing I could do. So the books keep romanticizing the young as though the young can bring change without an intergenerational movement.
Right.
So that weakens them and weakens us. Because we say, well, it's just the young people, and, you know. That, no. So, I don't maintain that I have a lot of the answers, but one of the answers I know in the black community is that small or larger groups of people need to examine their situation and determine in a small group or a large group, this is where we are going to work to bring change, and go after making that task their task, and to do it with nonviolent direct action.
We have so many issues, and I really wanted to get Nick in this because the last time Nick was here, we just very lightly tipped into the issue of the black man's image in this country, that he is now the criminal that everybody's afraid of, that he has been damaged, that he's a monster in the closet kind of thing, that this is a scenario they've created for him, in that we had Philando Castillo killed because it was assumed he was a criminal. Young man living in a right to carry state, you know, and killed by law enforcement. So I kind of wanted to get Nick to ask a question about that image, and isn't it important that we address that?
Absolutely. I mean, I know the issue of police violence, shooting down 12 and 13-year-old people, is a critical issue.
Yes.
And must be addressed. I have no doubts about that.
Mm-hmm. But I want to say something on the word assimilation, and it has to do with what you're saying, and Jaime as well. I want to see if I can maybe put something together if I speak carefully. So, what you're talking about, sister, in my opinion, is again a force. There is a historical force in Western culture that projects certain human qualities on certain groups of people. If you're a white man, then you are good in math and you kind of talk like this. And if you're a black man, then you can dance and you're good at some other Dionysian things. And so that's one thing. And when I talk about forces, what I mean to imply is that a lot of these things we talk about are not actual individual decisions. So the white man that shoots the black kid in the car is not, it's not helpful to look at that as an act of individual morality, because he's actually a little fish swimming in dirty water. He's almost an unconscious actor.
Yes.
So I don't want to get too far into that, because I want to talk about assimilation a little bit. My problem with the idea of black people banding together, buying Mississippi and living there together, is that it's too small for me. In my opinion, we are not 10% of the population of the United States. We're 50%, because there would be no United States economy without us. I don't want some of it. I want all of it. I don't want one little corner. We deserve all of it. And so when I hear Reverend Lawson talk about plantation capitalism and oppression, what I hear him talking about and what I would change assimilation into is the idea of dismantling and tearing down the idea of oppression, the idea that meant that I should get my self-esteem from my ability to dominate others, whether it's in Wall Street or whether it's in Compton. Mm. And that is a United States disease. And so attacking that and tearing that down to heal the black community, to me, becomes job one. And so I don't want to go too far into this, but I do want to say one thing. I've been around ceasefire and second call for a while, over 10 years, right? You remember I had the documentary. Mm-hmm. I got it to Quincy Jones. He told the person to tell me, nobody cares about the hood anymore, it's about Africa. So I understand the frustration of risking your life doing work in the community to save lives, like when Twain got shot in the head. I understand the frustration of like, well, why can't we get together and help our own kids? Like, right. I totally get the no help, where is help coming from?
Right.
Black Lives Matter gets $10 million and where does ceasefire? I get that. Right. But I say that another way to look at it may be, all right, well, if the upper class of our own communities aren't going to help us, then who would be partners in going against oppression? Because maybe it's annoying white girls. I'm not saying that that's a way to go, but I'm saying if tackling and dismantling oppression is the primary goal, then who are the actors that want to assist in that? And my primary feeling about the entire matter is that worldwide, if there is, let's just say that there's a worldwide plantation capitalism movement to make people slaves, the primary stance against that movement is us. We are a nation of people. I don't call myself African American because we may actually be something new. My ancestors survived something that no other human group of people has even been put up against on the planet, right? Which to me gives us a right and an authority to speak against oppression primarily and first before anyone. We actually should be the architect against oppression in our communities for sure.
I agree.
But the assimilation is, do you know what I mean? Assimilation has to be like not just taking some of it. We really, really, it's about reforming what American patriotism is, which is a movement for all people.
Let me ask a question this way, because I don't want to be hostile, but I am. When you say American, I don't feel like an American.
Because they took I'm not accepted
as an American.
Absolutely.
I'm not treated as an American. Right. My children,
just like
their
you said,
schools,
we're something else.
We're something else. We are something else.
But here's the thing. But here's the thing about that. So a document was written called the Declaration of Independence, right? And some men signed it.
Yeah.
And the second they signed it, they sold their soul and the soul of the word America into slavery.
Yes.
Because they sold it for money.
Yeah.
And then from that point on, the word America, in my opinion, went into our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And the proof is in our music.
Yes.
Because when you go to France or Bangkok or Ireland, America to them is James Brown and Ray Charles.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
So what I'm saying is, when I say we think too small, we've letting oppressors dictate this nation to us.
Yeah.
No. So that's exactly my point.
Yes.
My point is we don't have to. When we have individuals who've given their life, like James Lawson, like Harry Belafonte, like all these other great people.
Yeah. Dr.
King and Malcolm. But a lot of them still alive. That's why I didn't say Dr. King and Malcolm. We have so many still alive that why don't we create our own? I got my hero. Number 45 is not my hero. This is my hero right here. Harry Belafonte is my hero. Yeah. Danny Glover's my hero. Every Kawisi's dad, Charles Nesbitt. All the different, I can't even think
our
all the names.
Our heroes are right here,
and they're
in
still
our
alive.
Village from
they
our people, and we're not
Cecil
looking
Murray,
to them.
Cecil Murray, John Mack.
Yes.
These are my heroes.
Robert Farrell
came here.
Yes.
These are my heroes that are still alive.
Yes.
And what I believe is, before I go to UCLA, USC, or one of those schools, I would rather pay them the same tuition. Give me what you know.
Yeah.
And you say, yes, there's a 45, I don't know how big the gap is between you and him, but there's a 45-year gap between me and you. I need that. I need that information.
Yeah.
I need to sit down. I sit with Harry Belafonte every chance I get. I need to sit with others every chance I get because I need that so I can give it to Jaime, so I can give it to Carter and Cody.
Yeah.
And I don't need to pay UCLA.
Yeah.
They want it for a 4-year bachelor's degree. What would it cost me? $30,000 a semester?
Why not Charles Drew? Why do we always think UCLA, when there was a perfectly good, beautiful university out there attached to Dr. King's Hospital, and we let them trash that facility, tear it down, try to destroy the university, and we sat quiet, we sat silent? This is the frustration I was talking about. The difference in the movement that sustained you and made progress, and the nightmare that happened that stole him away from the community family. You see, there was a transition in there. Our forward movement was trashed, and it was trashed almost immediately after Dr. King's death. We knew Malcolm was going to be taken, and we knew that. We already knew that at the time. But what shocked us, sadly, we expected it, but it still shocked us that they killed Dr. King. Mm. But at the same time, it fractured us as a people. We seemed to lose our connectedness. This is what was missing in his generation, our connectedness to each other. And all these things turned because of that. Our kids in failing schools, our kids disenfranchised, our kids living hopeless. I'm going to just live as fast as I can because life is so ugly. I want to get out quick. I want to get out quick. I want to live large and in charge for this short time, and then I'm ready to make my exit. You see, so it gave soil, rich soil in his generation with that movement instead of sustaining as a black man, as a powerful leader to our kids and our village. You see, this is the thing that's hurt me the most, that we didn't get you in him. At his age, we're creating you in him. But he paid a heck of a price before he got here.
And so how do I not let legacies die like we have been for the past? Every time a leader falls, we lose a big chunk. We take major steps back, even from the Tupacs and the Biggies in our time. Yeah. Those are potential leaders that were leading the masses. And now when we fall, we turn into mourners, we turn into trauma victims, we turn into people that are hurt, that want to continue to be hurtful to other people. So how do a person like me pick up a torch of a legacy that's been left on the table that has not been picked up after Martin and Malcolm? Hmm.
We're asking you some questions.
Well, I really don't see you picking up whatever legacy you think that Malcolm or Martin left. Because I disagree with some of the black analysis of Malcolm and Martin. Until 1964, Malcolm belonged to a black cultic group, black Islam, that said all black people are the children of light and white people are the children of darkness. He, in fact, criticized our movement in the South because he said we were house Negroes.
Yes, he did. He said a lot of powerful things.
But 1964, he had changed that analysis.
Yes.
And he saw himself joining the emerging movement with Martin King to unite his own energy towards how we get rid of the injustice that black people were continuing to face at home and abroad. And that's not usually acknowledged as an analysis of where we're at. That Malcolm demonstrates in a phenomenal fashion the spiritual, moral, political emancipation of a man in the midst of racism.
That's awesome.
And a phenomenal human being.
Yeah.
King represents, on the other side, not so much a civil rights figure, which is what he's called, as a theologian who comes to the understanding that black people, in order to move ahead, in order to break the back of this tyranny we face, must organize from a nonviolent perspective and do direct action. And Martin never thought that in 10 years or 15 years we would solve the problems. What took the nation 400 years to develop could not even be understood by most of us, including me, with just 10 years of work. I mean, I say that over and over again to myself. It takes my entire life, 8 decades, and it takes present generation and future generations to throw their whole lives and continue the struggle in creative ways. And one of the creative ways it can continue is by our insisting to ourselves and to one another and to all of our children and young people, you are somebody. You are a child of the universe. You are a child of God. You are a child of love and truth and beauty and wonder. You have infinite mortality. You have infinite potential in your bones, in your genes. And you must strive not to allow this continued tyranny in the 21st century to tie you into any kind of bondage or shackles. And we have to know and understand that out of the 60s movement, the direct action campaign movements, people like Nixon and Todd Gitlin and other commentators have said that the 1960s were a turbulent, violent age. Now, they did not see, for an example, that across the United States, the white-colored signs came down. No dirty Irish signs came down in New England. No wetback signs. No Jap signs. No chink signs. No Jew signs. Those signs that were epidemic across our country by custom and law came down. We don't live in them now. That's an enormous change.
It's an invisible sign now in 2017. Right. Okay. The sign's still there, but it's invisible.
Well, no, the spirit, go back to what Nick said, the spirit is still
the
there.
The spirit is still there.
The spirit of hostility and ruthlessness.
Can we get you back, Dr. Lawson?
Yeah, see, because we're out of time.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, we're out of time already.
I get to hear him again Saturday. You were talking about how you get communicate the knowledge. I know we're out of time, but I saw him speak at UCLA with Cornel West and somebody else. I liked the rabbi. I liked what he was saying. I was annoyed by Cornel. Right. But okay. I heard Reverend Lawson talk, and I went up, and at first I scared him because I was like, I got it. Every class, I followed him every class. Yeah. Then I went to his workshop.
So where's the class? Let Jaime know where the class is.
Then I moved across the street. So Saturday morning, 9 o'clock, Holman Church on 4th and Adams. From 9 to 12, there's a workshop that he leads there, and I'll be there if you want to meet me there.
All right, we got to keep our head to the sky, y'all.
Yes, God bless you. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Well, thank you so much, sister.
We covered a lot of decades in this hour.
This was historic.
Yes, it was.
Don't go nowhere. We're going to get a picture. We don't have a lot of pictures and stuff.
God bless you, community family. Thank you for listening, and Gang Talk will be back next week. Mm-hmm.